Okay. Out. And out. All right, good.
Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahano Bhunaktu, Sahavidyan Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti 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 Chaitanyam Sarvagam Sarvam Sarva Bhuta Guhashayan Yat Sarva Vishayatitam Tasmai Sarva Vide Namaha.
Om Parameshwara. Very good. Welcome to you all, and welcome especially to the many students who are regularly attending these classes online. We'll continue today with our study of Shankara's Upadesha Sahasri. We're seeing, I think for the first time in our studies, where he's beginning this refutation of other schools of thought, and he is beginning in this chapter with refutation of Buddhism, in particular two particular schools of Mahayana Buddhism called Vijnanavada and Shunyavada. And I'm afraid that I've made a mistake in not really describing the schools of Buddhism very carefully. In fact, I got some interesting comments. Comments that, Swamiji, don't you know that Buddhism has scriptures? Don't I know that? I've studied those scriptures, so I must know. I think the confusion came from either the last class or the class prior to that, when I said, like, Hinduism is based on the Vedic scriptures, Buddhism is not based on a body of scriptures, but based on the teachings of Buddha. Now, the teachings of Buddha evolved into many, many kinds of scriptures, but Buddha, first of all, did not have a body of scriptures to study. He refuted the authority of the Vedas. So Buddha himself studied no scriptures, and he may have, we don't know, but he may have studied Upanishads before and other scriptures, but he ended up rejecting all of them. So my statement, which may have been misunderstood, I want to make sure I didn't misspeak. I often misspeak. I say wrong things. I did not mean to imply that Buddhism has no scriptures. And I'll give you a brief overview in just a moment. What I did mean to say is that, like, Hinduism is a whole collection of teachings based on the scriptures, of the Vedic scriptures. The Buddhism, which is also a whole variety of different groups, different teachings, is not based on a single scriptural foundation. It is based on the words of Buddha, and the words of Buddha then evolved into various scriptures. So we're talking about the foundation for a religious tradition. The foundation for the Hindu religious tradition is the Vedas. The foundation for the Buddhist traditions, all of them, is not a particular scripture, but rather the teachings of Buddha, which then evolved into various scriptures. Let me give you an overview. I'll go to the board. Let me switch this. And just to give you, I think I've made a mistake in not giving a little bit more of an overview, so let me try to do that today. Very briefly, we'll start around 500 BCE with Buddha. Is that going to show? Yes. Okay. So around 500 BCE, we start with Buddha's direct teachings, which were, Buddha, of course, was born in Nepal. He taught mostly in North India. I don't recall what language he spoke, but his disciples recorded his teachings in the Pali language. And those Pali teachings are referred to now as the tradition called Theravada. You recognize that Vada from, we've seen Shunyavada and Vijnanavada. Here, Tara is the Pali word for the old ones, the revered ones. So Theravada is the old tradition. So as I said, it came up in India and Nepal. And then it left the India's borders, went to Sri Lanka, and significantly Thailand, I think also Cambodia, Vietnam, South India, South Asia. And even today in Sri Lanka and Thailand, the Buddhism as it's practiced resembles very much the Buddhism taught by Buddha himself, compiled in the Pali language into a set of scriptures, those set of Pali, they call it the Pali canon. Let me give you some of this terminology. Pali canon. By the way, canon is a Latin word, meaning a canon. You've heard the term canonical text, that kind of canon. Not one that you shoot in a battlefield. So the Buddhists in Sri Lanka and Thailand continue to follow that Pali canon. Then and this is going to be quite brief, and bird's eye view, they call it. By 200 CE, a new tradition was evolving called Mahayana. Yana here is path. So this is the great path. And the great path, they felt apparently, in fact, there was a lot of debate between these two groups, and they said that ours is the greater path. So they used a unfavorable word for this group. They called them Hinayana, which means you're lowly, we're great. Isn't it amazing? The same thing going on back in these days. We have the same name calling going on today. Anyway, to me, it's name calling. So this Mahayana tradition also in 200 CE in India. In 200 CE, India was largely a Buddhist country. Islam has not yet existed, and Buddhism was accepted as a state religion, and it thrived in India. It also evolved. Now the scriptures are changing. The scriptures are no longer in Pali. Now the scriptures are in Sanskrit. Many important scriptures in Sanskrit. And then it left India, went to China, and then we have not only a collection of Sanskrit scriptures, now we have Chinese scriptures. And then it went to both Japan and Korea. This is when the Zen tradition comes in. But I should mention that it's no longer resembles the Mahayana found in the Sanskrit scriptures. So this was an evolution as it left India, went into China, it began to evolve. When it went into Japan and Korea, evolved still more to the point of if Buddha could look at those teachings, he wouldn't find them recognizable. A good example of that is in Japan. Some of you know this already. The Buddhism that's practiced is highly intermixed with their indigenous Shinto religion. So most people in Japan, they don't really make a difference. They intermix Shinto and Buddhism. They have a nice tradition. When you're born, you get Shinto rituals. When you die, you get Buddhist rituals. This is what they do. Anyway, but our focus is on scripture. So here we start with the Pali Canon, then we have Sanskrit scriptures. There's a lot of Chinese scriptures. And then, of course, you find local scriptures in Japanese and Korean. And then probably around 700 or maybe even a little bit later than that, not BC, but CE, Buddhism finally made its way to Tibet. It's a latecomer in Tibet. Geographically, you can kind of imagine, I don't know how to say, if this is India, so first it made its way south, and then it made its way north, and then it made its way east into Japan, Korea, etc. And then finally it made its way west into Tibet. So it's really a geographical spread of these teachings over a period of many centuries. And so it finally reached Tibet. There are at least four major, each one of these have many sub-schools. We've been talking about Mahayana having four sub-schools, Tibetan Buddhism also four sub-schools, and a huge body of literature now in the Tibetan language. So we have a Pali Canon, we have Sanskrit scriptures, Chinese scriptures, Tibetan scriptures, lots of scriptures. All of these scriptures are based more or less on the immediate teachings of Buddha. So they are of... And the significance for our study today is that they're of human origin. That's an important point. Buddha was a human being. He was acknowledged by his peers as an enlightened human being. The idea of Buddha being a divinity evolved only later. And out here, Buddha becomes a deity. But initially, he was an enlightened human being, which means the teachings of Buddhism are of, we must say, of human origin. They have no claim to any divine basis. In fact, a great number of Buddhists deny any divinity at all. They don't have any concept of Ishvara, but rather they have elevated teachers like Buddha to the status of divine beings. And then in Tibetan Buddhism seems to have borrowed a lot of Hindu traditions. So they have their own demigods and all these deities and all of that. That's a relatively recent invention, so we'll leave that aside. Okay, this is just meant to give you an overview for two reasons. One is to correct any misunderstanding. Hinduism is based on Vedic scriptures, which are said to be of divine origin. Buddhism is based on the immediate teachings of Buddha, which are not claimed. They have a divine origin. They are originated with a human being. Now, the significance of that we're going to see in today's class. Let's get back here. And let's get where we left off. As we were talking about Shankara... Remember the last class, Shankara was arguing with two schools of Mahayana Buddhism, the Shunyavadis, the ones who say that there's no underlying reality, no Brahman, and Vijnanavadis, the one who says there's no unchanging consciousness that we understand as Atma. So in his refutation of these Buddhist schools of thought, Shankara very delightfully used their own weapon against them, reasoning. So his argument was based entirely on reasoning with no recourse to scripture. And we talked about the significance of that. If you get into an argument with a Christian, immediately scripture comes. And your opponent in the argument claims that the scripture is authoritative, and you deny the authoritativeness of that scripture. So the argument goes nowhere, because there's not a level playing field. But here, Shankara creates a level playing field. He argues not on the basis of scripture, but only on the basis of logic. He argues against the validity of these Buddhist ideas. Now, to make the connection and to move ahead today. Since Buddhism is based on human thought, human thought means ideas, concepts, and in our last verse that we saw last week, they're called vikalpa. Vikalpa means these various ideas. Vikalpa, idea or concept, would be a good translation. And Buddhism is full of ideas and concepts because they have no choice. Remember, I said that if the Hindu, especially if the Vedantic tradition, is like a three-legged table, Shruti, Yukti, Anubhava, Shruti, scripture, Yukti, reasoning, Anubhava, experience. Buddhism is like a two-legged table because they don't accept Shruti. So we have only Yukti and Anubhava. And the Yukti means it's Yukti. The Yukti, the logic they use, got quite elaborate. I gave the example in the last class where they had this fourfold deconstruction. They'd say something either is or it is not, or it both is and is not, or it neither is nor is not. Look at that. That last one is very messy, I think. Anyway, that's an example of the kind of hair-splitting logic they engaged in. So now Shankara has already criticized in this verse. He says, all your hair-splitting logic, none of that existed before Atma existed. He said, all of it, which is to say, all of it is a product of the human mind. And we continue to have this problem. Can a finite human mind in and of itself transcend its limits and reach that which is truly beyond thought and mind? The Taittiriya Upanishad famously says, Yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasasaha, famous, much quoted statement that says, that which we seek is beyond the mind and words, and it returns without having grasped the truth. Words and the mind return, having failed to grasp that lofty truth. So, Vedanta admits the limitations of mind and words. Buddhism doesn't accept the limitations of mind and words. Buddhism feels that mind and words, philosophy in other words, is completely adequate. And do I want to make that point here? Where do I want? Okay, we'll set that aside for just a few moments. So let's work our way back to the text after this rather lengthy introduction. So Shankara now has refuted all these Buddhist vikalpas, ideas and concepts based on pure logic. Having done so, now finally Shankara is going to call upon Hindu scriptures, meaning he is no longer arguing with the Buddhists, now he's teaching us, students of Vedanta. So it's a shift of perspective. This verse that you're looking at is an argument with the Buddhists. The following verse, where we pick up the thread today, is not an argument for the Buddhists, but it's addressing us by calling upon certain scriptural passages. So that's where we'll begin. Vacharambhana Shastracha, Vacharambhana Shastracha, Vikaranam Hyabhavata, Vikaranam Hyabhavata, Mrityo Samrityo Mitye. Mrityo Samrityo Mityadir, Mrityo Samrityo Mityadir, Mamam. Mama mayeti cha smritehe, mama mayeti smritehe. All right. So first he quotes from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad that says everything is vak arambhana. Everything is born of words, shastrat. According to the shastra called Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, in that Upanishad there's this famous passage which he's quoting just a few words of, which is now supporting his criticism of Buddhism being all ideas. And now, having used logic to criticize this just ideas and concepts, bare ideas and concepts of Buddhism, having criticized that according to logic, now he is giving a scriptural basis for his criticism. So the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad says, Vacharambhanam, it's all mere words. And the truth we seek is not the meaning of any word. We admit the limitations of words, even when we use Brahman. Brahman is it. Let's just make sure we get the. There's a little bit of language we have to something about language, linguistics we have to understand here. This object is not a pot. The object is what it is. Pot is a name we give it, and you could call it ghatam if you want, which is the Sanskrit word for pot. It's arbitrary. Words are arbitrary. This object is not arbitrary. Words are arbitrary. So according to this passage in the Brihadaranyaka, Shankara criticizes that Buddhists are just using all these words, and they're not they're as definitive as words can be. By the way, Shankara no doubt had great respect for the reasoning found in Buddhist scriptures. Shankara himself must have studied those scriptures and must have benefited from that study. But he rejects the approach of Buddhism, which is based primarily on philosophical ideas. So he says, based on this passage from the Brihadaranyaka, which says everything is just mere words, vikaranam, he abhavata. You can establish the abhavata, the absence of true meaning, vikaranam, for all of these modifications, for all of these various expressions. So he's just now shifting the basis for his argument from logic to scripture. Scripture says all of your words that you use, if he's addressing the Buddha, saying all of these words, or addressing us, all of the words used by the Buddhists are just words, ideas, concepts, which cannot reach to the highest truth. Then he quotes from the Katha Upanishad, Mrityoho Samrityum iti adehe. The passage that begins, Mrityoho Samrityum, I'd look it up. I don't remember all of this stuff, so I looked it up. And the rest of the passage, it doesn't make any sense unless you will see the last part of the passage. First part just says, Mrityoho Samrityum, from death to death. Yeah? What? So you have to look at the passage, and it says, Mrityoho Samrityum Gacchati Ya Iha Nana Iva Pashyati. One who sees duality, this is what the Katha Upanishad says, one who accepts the reality of duality, one who accepts the world as being absolutely real, that person, mrityoho mrityum gacchati, that person goes from death to death. It's often been the common joke is that when you say Hindus are born again and again and again, it's often said that that's overly optimistic. Because it's equally true that you die again and again and again. That doesn't sound as good, but that's what the Katha Upanishad says here. So the Katha here now is saying those who accept multiplicity fail to get enlightened. Multiplicity, go back to that example I gave, the Buddhist logic, it is not. It both is and is not. It neither is nor is not. So this kind of, what do they call it? Slice and dice. This is kind of a kitchen term. This kind of dividing things up into parts is a multiplicity, is a duality. And the Katha Upanishad says, those who are stuck at that level of duality, they will not get enlightened. And then one more quote he gives from the Bhagavad Gita, Mama Maya iti cha smritehe, and also from the smriti, shruti is a word we use for the Upanishads, Vedic scriptures. Smriti is a word we use for other scriptures, including the Bhagavad Gita. So smritehe, from the Bhagavad Gita, we find a statement, Mama Maya. Again, Sri Krishna says, My Maya. We're missing something. The very next word, Dur Atyaya, is difficult to transcend, difficult to understand, difficult to grasp. And what he's suggesting, or the reason Shankara is quoting that, is he's saying that these Buddhists are lost in this maya in the form of words, this tangle of ideas and concepts. And as long as they're stuck at that level with worldly ideas and concepts, which are have all this slice and dice kind of thing, all these divisions, all this multiplicity. So he says, Shankara says, based on all these scriptures, they are stuck, meaning they being the Buddhists. Now, with the next verse, Shankara concludes this whole train of thought criticizing the Buddhists, and that'll give me an opportunity to make some really important observations I was going to make before, but better that they come here. Vishuddhischatahevasya vikalpachavilakshanat upadeyo naheyota upadeyo naheyota atmananyarakalpitah. Vishuddhihi ataha. Therefore, there is something which is vishuddhi. And Shankara uses that here as a word to describe atma, that which is utterly pure, that which is utterly unaffected by anything else, that which is a reality beyond mind and words. So, what came first, object or name? Right? Names come later. Reality comes first. So here, if you take it a very philosophical view, yeah, Atma is the primary thing. All of these words and ideas are later additions. And Shankara, first using logic, then using scripture, is highly critical. And he says, how can you rely on these arbitrary names, ideas, and concepts to try to understand a reality that is transcendent. Transcendent and even primary, that which came first. It would be like trying to understand, interesting comparison, linguists like doing this kind of thing, I'm not sure I like it so much, but understand this object without using the word pot. And that shows how habituated we are to language. We're addicted to language. We are so used to using language. We say pot, and then we stop thinking about it. But if you would take, if you throw away that word pot, you might gain some new insights about this object. So language necessarily limits. And what Shankara is arguing against here is why confine yourself to language? Language in a general sense, yukti or reasoning, in a more specific sense. Why confine yourself? He says, with regard to Atma, which is vikalpa cha vilakshanat, which is vilakshanat, Atma, which is utterly unlike any vikalpa, any idea or concept. Again, a little bit of language here. The word pot and this object have what in common? You get the point? Nothing in common. Nothing at all. Pot is actually a one syllable word having three letters. It has that certain sound. It's a word. It has a sound. This is not a word. This is not a sound. There is no similarity whatsoever between the object and the word. And you can see Shankara is making a powerful argument here. And the argument is about, as I just said, limiting yourself to words, which means limiting yourself to the domain of reasoning. Or to put it in the other perspective, throwing away the, not throwing, chopping, we have to use the right metaphor, chopping off the third leg of the table. What is the third leg of the table? Scripture, Shruti. So from Shankara's standpoint, Buddhists have chopped off that leg of scripture, and that's not an unfair interpretation, because Buddha did indeed fail to accept the authoritativeness of the Vedic scriptures. He rejected it, and that's just a fact. So he did indeed figuratively cut off that third leg of them. Now, finishing this argument about the insufficiency of logic, he says that Atma, and you can see in the fourth line, Atma na upadeyaha na heyaha. Atma is not something you can grasp with words or negate by words. Atma cannot be grasped or negated by words, because what is the connection between limitless consciousness and the word Atma. Just like the relationship between this object and the word pot. There's no connection. We use the word sangati, linguistical. By the way, I should say that in the scholarly Hindu traditions, there's a lot of very deep discussion about all this stuff. And I tried to study all of that. It really breaks your head because they ask these questions. What is the relationship between an object and the word? And there are various theories to describe it. We don't need to go into all of that. But what we do know is there is no immediate direct relationship between this object and the word pot. The word pot is completely arbitrary. In the same way, what is the relationship between your true nature and the word Atma? Same. Atma is just a name. It's just a word. So, we recognize the limitations of words, and therefore he says, na anyaihi akalpitaha. And I checked several texts, which it has to be vikalpitaha. Akalpita doesn't give the right meaning at all. I think the text somehow got messed up. It was probably vikalpitaha. Atma is na anyaihi, not by others. Vikalpitaha, Atma is not a projection of others. Or we could say the word Atma is a projection. Your true nature is no projection. So, just to wrap this up before we move on to the next topic. Now, all of this shows a two-legged table is not very stable. And that really represents Buddhism having chopped off that third leg of scripture. That means we can take it one step further. So, if you chop off the leg of scripture, you're left with reasoning and anubhava experience. Reasoning and experience. So all schools of philosophy are based on reasoning and experience. That means Western schools and Indian schools of philosophy are based on reasoning and experience. What else is based on reasoning and experience that's very popular nowadays, very important nowadays? Science. Science is based on reasoning and experience. That's also, science means observation. Actually, first you make an observation, you make a hypothesis, you create an experiment, you do the experiment, you analyze the results. It's all anubhava and yukti, experience and analysis. They would call it science. So what Shankara is saying here could be applied not merely to various philosophies, including Buddhist philosophies, but could equally be applied to science, which is not a criticism of science, because we all benefit from science. If not for science, I'm just looking around to see our ages. I think if not for science, we'd all be dead by now. Because medical science has extended our lifespans tremendously. So if it weren't for science, we wouldn't be sitting here. We'd all have died in our 30s, by our 30s. So we we praise science and its advances, but we also recognize the limitations of science when it comes to your true nature. This is our Vedantic perspective. Okay, so now we go to a new topic. We'll just see a verse or two quickly. Very nice. We're done with this argument against Buddhism. By the way, if you remember, I actually spared you some of the details of this argument. Remember, we skipped over a number of verses. where Shankara or any great Vedantin gets into arguments with other schools of thought, the teachings become excessively, well, let me just say it, excessively dry. Because it's just, first of all, it's just logic, and that's a little inherently dry. Secondly, it's all refutation. What do you get out of that? So it has value at the level of Vedantic manana, if you have any kind of doubts, or if you're, this is a process that really goes very deeply into details and is helpful in a manner of speaking. But if you say, how does that help me get free from suffering? It doesn't. Which is why manana comes only after shravana. Shravana is where discovery of your true nature takes place. Manana nididhyasana serve to remove obstacles only, later obstacles. Enlightenment is a result of shravana. Enlightenment is certainly not the result of these arguments. Okay, where are we? Here we are. Aprakasho yatha ditye, aprakasho yatha ditye, nasti jyotisvabhavatah, nasti jyotisvabhavatah, nityabodhasvarupatvan, nityabodhasvarupatvan, nagnanam tadvaratmani, nagnanam tadvaratmani. Now we're back to Shankara in a more familiar manner. So we've just finished a pretty extensive detour where he's gone and refuted these schools of Buddhism, but now we're back to Shankara's main focus in this entire text, Upadesha Sastri, and the main focus is really on your true nature as Satchidananda Atma. Now, to introduce this verse, Let's introduce the. There's a style of writing commentaries. A commentary on this verse is by one Ramakrishna several hundred years ago. And in that commentary, he introduces every verse by putting a question in Shankara's mouth. So Shankara doesn't really have these questions, but it's a scholarly technique of introducing verses. So here, the question, which is to say that every verse is meant to answer an imaginary question. And so the question that the commentator imagines here is, how can you be so sure that consciousness isn't affected by your mind or body? It sure seems to be affected. When sadness arises in your mind, you don't say, my mind is sad. You say, I am sad. Or that word I refers to yourself as a conscious being. It feels like sadness affects your true nature. Is it so? And that's what Shankara addresses here. Obviously the answer is no, but let's see how Shankara addresses it. He gives a metaphor. And the metaphor is, yatha aditye, just like in the sun. So the sun is surrounded by the darkness of space. Is it not? The sun... by the way, don't get too scientific about these metaphors. They're images, so we're not meant to analyze this scientifically. The sun is in the darkness of space. Does the darkness of space affect the brightness of the sun? It's surrounded by the darkness of space. It's unaffected. So it says, prakasha, aprakashaha, the darkness of space, yatha aditye nasti, the darkness of space, nasti, is not present, aditye, in the sun. The darkness of space doesn't affect the sun. Why? Jyotisvabhavataha. Because the sun is nothing but brightness, light. So since the very nature of the sun is light, you can't stick darkness in it. Because the sun will not change its nature from being bright to dark. The sun by nature is bright. Now here's a metaphor. The metaphor is the light of the sun represents consciousness. And the question is, can sadness and all the other problems of the mind, which Shankara kind of sums it up with the word ajnanam in the last line. So, ajnanam, ignorance, representing sadness and all of our problems. Can all of that affect consciousness? And let's see his argument here. In the third line, na ajnanam tadvat atmani. So, connecting to the metaphor, just as the darkness of space cannot affect the sun, tadvat, in the last line, in the same way, na ajnanam atmani. Ajnana, ignorance, and all the effects of ignorance, like sadness, anger, frustration, whatever nonsense happens to be in the mind, none of that, atmani, can be present in consciousness, can affect consciousness. Consciousness can't be affected because nitya bodha surupatvat. Because consciousness is, sorry, consciousness is consciousness. Sun is light. Consciousness is consciousness. So the darkness of space can't affect the sun because the sun is light by nature. The features of your mind can't affect consciousness because consciousness is unchanging. In fact, that's his next argument, is unchanging consciousness. Let me put it like this. Ignorance and all of its evolutes, if we can use that word, are all aspects of tamas. Of our three gunas, sattva, rajas, tamas, ignorance and anything that comes from ignorance, like sadness, we would consider to be tamas. Tamas is a feature of the material world. Atma, consciousness, is not a feature of, is not one more thing in the world, as we've discussed many times. In fact, we've observed many times that Atma is Nirguna. So I ask, what color is your consciousness? Hey, what a ridiculous question. Consciousness is Nirguna. If consciousness is Nirguna, how do you stick tamas into it? How do you stick ignorance into it? How do you stick sadness into it? All of these are gunas. There is such a thing as sadness and ignorance. They belong to the mind, not to consciousness. We've had this discussion before. So, gunas, like tamas and their evolutes, ignorance, sadness, all of this stuff, cannot affect. I need to get one more metaphor here. Does this pot confine space within it? Yeah. not really. Of course, it appears to, but really speaking, pot cannot confine space. And the reason is these are two utterly different kinds of realities. So pot is a mere name and form, whereas space is at least from an ancient Hindu standpoint, space is a fundamental element. So it seems like space confines. It seems like pot confines space, but these are two different realities. In fact, we'll go back to the earlier discussion. What is the relationship? Well, that's interesting. If we ask that question, what is the relationship between pot and space? Watch this. And you've seen this before. Is space inside the pot? Yes, but. And that but is important. From one perspective, absolutely, you say space is inside the pot. But it's far more correct to say the pot is in space. So this is our Vedantic perspective. Is consciousness affected by sadness? No. Even when sadness... Oh, there's a metaphor. Give me just a moment. I've never tried this before. Even though space is in the pot, space is unaffected by the pot. Make sense? Even though space is inside the pot, space is not affected by the pot. Even though sadness is in your consciousness is not affected by the sadness. The metaphor works. Space is in the pot, but unaffected by the pot. Sadness can be in your consciousness. Well, you're aware of sadness. When you're aware of sadness, we say it's in your consciousness, yet consciousness remains unaffected just as space remains unaffected. Okay, Shankara gives one more argument, a similar argument in the next verse, and then we'll end our class with this next verse. He says, Tatha vikriya rupatvan, tatha vikriya rupatvan, navastantaramatmanaha, avastantaravatvehi, Nashosyasyanasamshayaha. I'm going to change my mind, because this verse introduces the idea of avastha antara, different states. So this verse is going to talk about, does Atma have three states, waking, dream, and sleep? Does Atma have four states? Turiya. And Shankara says, how can that which is unchanging have any states at all? So that discussion comes in this verse, which we'll hold off for the next class because it connects to the next topic. Does Atma have states of bondage and freedom? Atma transitions from a state of being bound to a state of being free. Those states are also negated by Shankara. Since these verses go together, we'll save this verse for the next class, and we'll conclude with our prayers. Om
Sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhagvavet, asato ma satgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma hamritangamaya, om shanti shanti shanti, om tat sat. All right. It's off.